Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School at the ANU. And I'm joined once again by my fabulous co-host, Anna-Greta Hunter, who is the Human Futures Fellow at the College of Health and Medicine here at ANU as well. Anna-Greta, hi.
Hi, Sharon. Great to see you again.
Policy Forum Pod is produced by policyforum.net, right here at the Crawford School of Public Policy, which is the Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy school. So listeners, don't forget to check out the amazing range of degree programs and short courses that we have on offer, including, very relevant for the conversations we're having at the moment, the Indigenous and Development Policy Specialisation, which is part of a Master of Public Policy. You can check out what we've got on offer at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. And welcome to this very special episode where we are delighted to have an incredible guest with us. Anna-Greta, what are we talking today?
Oh, thank you for that great introduction, Sharon. I think today we're going to talk about, again, about complex and interrelated challenges. And as many of us know, as we tackle these difficult questions that face contemporary humanity, the challenges of the 21st century, we often find ourselves looking to history for guidance and learning. We examine events that are both contemporary and remote. We learn from thinkers and leaders and examples that can be thousands of years old. Australia is home to the oldest system of knowledge and civilization. With more than 60,000 years of history, the knowledge, understanding and systems of our First Nations people are extraordinary, and we're beginning to appreciate this as a nation. The colonisation of Australia more than 200 years ago occurred with quite a deep falsehood at its moral and legal core, that of terra nullius. This falsehood was ingrained over generations of colonisers and other migration, and it was magnified through policy interventions like the stolen children. Leaving our Indigenous population disposed and invisible in their own land. The need for truth-telling about Australia's Indigenous heritage and culture is recognised. Through the 1967 referendum, the Mabo and Wick High Court findings of native title, through the national apology, progress has been made on challenges that could have been addressed hundreds of years earlier. Yet today, we still measure the impact of colonisation through the gap in life expectancy, increasing incarceration and ingrained daily racism that is experienced by our Indigenous population. There is still much truth to tell, much reconciliation to achieve, and much balance to restore. Truth-telling is painful for both colonisers and colonised, and yet the opportunities for all Australians to benefit from the process are real, and the time for this is well overdue. Last week, we had an extraordinary discussion with Dr. Virginia Marshall about country, the Indigenous relationship with land, and its central importance to well-being. Today, we want to move beyond silos to talk about the well-being of all Australians and to ask whether it's possible to achieve that without a healing process of truth-telling that seeks to acknowledge our nation's history and bring genuine reconciliation.
Thanks, Anna-Greta. I was reflecting as you were talking for a moment on the series that we had last year on wellbeing, and perhaps the most powerful message for me that came out of that series was the importance of listening. And I think there are few people that it is more important to listen to than our guest today. We are honoured and delighted to welcome Patricia Anderson AO. Patricia, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you, Anna-Greta.
I think most of our listeners will know you, Pat, but let me fully introduce you. Patricia Anderson AO is an Alawari woman who has built a national and an international reputation as a powerful advocate for the health of Australia's First Peoples. With an extensive career spanning community development, policy formation, and research ethics, Pat has dedicated her life to creating and nurturing understanding and compassion between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians. And this idea of compassion is also something that came out of the Wellbeing series so powerfully. As a well-published writer, Pat has served as chair of multiple organisations, including the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance Northern Territory, and then the Prime Minister's Referendum Council. She is the inaugural patron of the Women's Safety Services of Central Australia and has presented to the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous Peoples. Pat co-authored that remarkable report, Little Children Are Sacred, which was the report into child abuse in the Northern Territory. She is the chair of the Lewitcha Institute and was co-chair of the Referendum Council that delivered that incredibly powerful and important document, the Uluru Statement from the Heart. She is also 2021's ACT Senior Australian of the Year. Congratulations on that, Pam, but what a remarkable career. It is such a joy to have you here with us today.
Thank you, Sharon. It has been a very long career. I actually started work when I was 15. So I've been in the space a very long time.
And Pat, it's some of that deep knowledge and experience that we want to have the chance to talk through with you today. And I wanted to start off by asking you sort of broadly about these issues of health and well-being that we've been so focused on in this pod over the past couple of months. And can we start by talking specifically about the health and the well-being of First Nations people? You have a long history of involvement in Aboriginal health and well-being. How do you describe the health and well-being of our Indigenous peoples at this point in time?
Not good. I mean, we have the worst statistics, and Anna-Greta went through briefly through some of them. Those statistics, the number might change, but we are still behind in every marker, every indicator that still happens. To say that nothing's changed is not correct, of course. You know, but we still have the lowest, well, in the Northern Territory, generally across the country, education levels are still low. We still have the highest unemployment rates. And in the Northern Territory, where I come from, we have, I reckon, two generations who, in fact, can't read and write. And these are kids that have been in the system since they were sort of five. Now, if that was anywhere else in the world, I think there would be a national outcry. And those sorts, I think that's reflected too across the nation, up the top, above the 26th parallel, if you like. That is a different world and different set of circumstances. On the other hand, I mean, when I was around, we had, like in Alice Springs, for instance, we had a 100% increase in the number of Aboriginal kids who'd successfully completed year 12, and the number was one. So those were the kind of statistics when I was growing up. And now, of course, we have a lot of kids and a lot of programs, a lot of support for our young people to, and in fact, encourage them sometimes aggressively, and I think a lot of families do this as well, to make sure their kids do complete year 12, because if you don't, you know, as you know, there's nowhere to go unless you've got that. But so that's happening across the country, but not, like I say, not to the same extent in other parts of the world, because we do, in the world, Australia, because we do have communities where, you know, there's like 90% unemployment. And sometimes there are jobs in those communities, but people are not literate enough, like in a workshop, for instance, to be able to read the occupational health and safety rules. They can't read the job sheet, so they can't work because they have this lack of literacy. I'm involved in a literacy for life program, which is a Cuban model, and I've read about this in the 60s. About what was happening in Cuba. Always wanted to go there. Still haven't got there. And they go around the world, the Cubans, teaching people in their own language to read and write, and so people are literate. And we've been able to, we're a small group of and myself and others, we knew about this. So now we have Literacy for Life operating here modestly at the for the moment here in Australia, but it's a very successful adult literacy and I am really passionate about that because, as you all know, we can't go anywhere unless you can darn well read. In the past, in my day, people had to suspend who they were to get an education. Well, that's not the case anymore. You don't have to do that. But there's still not enough in my part of the world anyhow for people to read and write. And if the parents can't read and write, they don't encourage the children. But with this program, when you teach the parents and the grandparents, they get onto their kids and make sure. And there are lovely stories from New South Wales where it's mainly been run out only through lack of money, and it's successful. We got a grant from ARC to empirically prove how it worked. It was difficult finding a formula. So there's still a lot of work that needs. How do you measure empirically the effects of a mother or a grandmother or a grandfather learning to read so they can help their kids at school? But there's been these amazing stories about, like in the break, when kids come back, especially the little ones, you've got to pretty much revive, you know, get them back reading again. Whereas with the Aboriginal kids that we've heard about, they actually come to school ready to sort of sitting there, you know, all, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to go, because their grandparent or somebody in that household has alert with been through the program, and they get onto the kids, so they make them read 20 minutes, half an hour every day of the school holidays. Mind you, I don't know how they do that, but they do. And we've had these lovely letters from classroom teachers saying the impact. They now know the parents of the kids at school. They're achieving. They're attentive. They're there. One story after the other. Anyhow, sorry, well, taking too much.
No, we should be able to measure that through health outcomes, Pat. That's yes. One of the places we should see that is these social determinants of health.
Yes.
And we know that education is one of the strongest social determinants of health.
Yes.
But I just wonder about that relationship between these social determinants, so where we live and how we live and what sort of education we can get access to and engage with, and the cultural determinants of health. So how important it is to acknowledge Indigenous heritage and identity as part of facilitating. And you were saying that you didn't, that these days people aren't giving up their identity to engage.
No.
How can we, is that an important part of?
Yes, it is.
Yep.
It is. And it was sort of my generation, really. And just looking back, it was very difficult for people that I know and still know today. Whereas, you know, when they went home or were achieving and everybody around them wasn't, it was a hard space, hard space to fill. So, and it was, hurtful as well. And then, of course, wherever they were in the institution, they were the subject of all kinds of forms of racism, overt and covert, you know. So it was a really, really uncomfortable, really difficult place for us. I think probably my generation, maybe there was a couple after me, at least one, that it was not comfortable to be educated.
Yep.
But nevertheless, there are families, and there always have been families that wanted everybody to be educated. I know this great story. When I was doing a community education program, I was out at Kalkaringi, and I was sitting around with a group of people, and the old man told me this story. They said, "You know, my girl, we need to know everything about that kangaroo, where he eats, where he goes, what he drinks, how he travels. We need to know everything about that kangaroo. Now, we don't want to be that kangaroo, but we want to catch him and eat him." That was their description to me of education. We need to have all these skills. We don't want to be like them,
yep.
But we need what they have so as we can survive.
Yep.
And I've never forgot that story.
A really powerful analogy.
But how much is the education system at the moment, and maybe you want to talk specifically to the Northern Territory, you know, where you're from, but more broadly across the country, how close are we in terms of the education system of being able to meet the needs of Indigenous children and their families and to provide the kind of knowledge that we all need in the contemporary world without losing the traditional knowledge that families provide, the culture provides, the country provides?
Issues of culture, I think they belong at home. However, when the kids go to school, look, they are a lot of our kids all over the country, the year 12, lots of kids at school. The schools are really trying, there's no doubt about that. But they don't see themselves at school. There's the history, you know, of contact and what happened, the history of Australia, which in fact is not 200 and a few years plus. It's actually 65,000 years old and growing as we speak. The more and more sophisticated the tools and counting gets, that figure just keeps going. There's some people that, you know, say 80 to 100,000 years. But anyhow, be that as it may, that's still not really, there's not this integrated history that's taught to all kids at school. So our kids don't see themselves. I mean, I remember this terrible story. It was terrible in hindsight. I think I was in about grade 3 or 4 and the teacher was up the front and I really liked her, and she was talking about Captain Cook, and I'm sitting there and I'm looking at her and I'm listening. She's saying how he came and there was no people here, and I'm thinking, well, that's not true. And that realisation was quite profound, because I remember sitting back in my chair, well, she's a liar. She's just telling me rubbish and I don't believe her anymore. So I just tuned out, because you can't trust these people is what I learned. And that's a terrible lesson. What was I, 10? Yeah. You know, I thought that was a terror. In hindsight, I realised how horrible that lesson was that I learned, because what I learned was that white people can't be trusted because they tell lies. So schools are really a microcosm of all kinds of things. But getting back to the history, I think Australians really don't know much about themselves. They know very, very, very little about us. And there's this barrier. It seems to be like a psychological barrier. But they want to sort of block us out, make us invisible. We are here. And we feel like, you know, when you're a kid and you want to join a game and you're jumping up and down with your hand, you know, pick me, pick me. Well, that's how I sometimes feel like I'm waiting to join in the skipping rope game, but nobody will let me in. So I think that still happens today. And we wonder why doesn't Australia want to accept, acknowledge, respect its history? It's bloody, but it happened, you know, and all sorts of things happen, like in any societies all over the world. I don't know, I, for the life of me, even from this great distance that I am now, I cannot figure that out, why there is this reluctance. And it's excruciating, you know, when you get public figures like the Prime Minister, they don't, the history is so, it isn't, I feel like saying, reaching him up and saying, Prime Minister, can I get Henry Reynolds to come and give you a tutorial on Australian history, please?
This truth of colonisation, I think, is a tremendously important part of reconciliation. How much difference do you think it makes to the health and well-being of our Indigenous population and maybe even the broader Australian population if we can start that?
Oh, profound.
Yeah.
I mean, the health and level of sophistication or a civilised society is how it treats its, not only its Indigenous folk, but the most vulnerable in their communities, like the young and the ageing. We haven't got a very good track record here in Australia. You know, us, aged people, my goodness, and young people, you know. So we don't measure at all very well using that kind of criteria. Australia's very bad. We got a lot of work to do in this country. There are a lot of challenges facing us all, and I'm hoping that young people will be a little bit educated, or a bit more educated, sorry, about some of these issues, and people talking more about. There is a shift in the country, I think. There's a more openness to the kind of things that I'm saying. Whereas I think previously I would have been shut down by now, and that has happened and did happen. But that's not the case anymore. So people aren't prepared to listen. Well, there's a growing sector of Australia that's prepared to listen. I mean, the people who are opposed to the 26th of January, there's more and more Australians who are, if not out on the streets publicly supporting it, are at home watching and feeling very, very uncomfortable.
Mm.
And that's not a bad thing, I think. That's good.
Yeah.
Feeling uncomfortable is a really, really good place to start.
Yeah. So do you think it is a discussion about the 26th of January would be a good place to start in terms of truth-telling and reconciliation? Is that one of the points where
it's just
shift?
One.
It's just one.
It's just one. What we need to do, in my view, is change the narrative of the country
mm-hmm.
so as we understand who we are. It's a wonderfully diverse, really, really interesting country that we have, and lots of amazing people that live in it. But it's like, oh, no, 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 we can't go there. You know, we don't want to be too good. I don't know what it is. I don't know why we don't fully and completely celebrate and be proud of our history, the good bits, the bad bits. Truth-telling is what I think is really, really important because we don't tell you much. We know all about your history. You don't know too much about us, and there's good reasons for not revealing too much because that doesn't work. But the schools can do a lot better. Oh, you know, I've been rabbiting on for decades about the curriculum. Me and a few others. I mean, a lot of us worked in education who are very prominent now. People like Linda Burney, Ken White. Lots of people around, scattered around the country. We all worked in Aboriginal education years and years and years ago. And we were going on then about change the curricula. Teachers aren't trained to teach us, and the curricula needs to be changed. And I'm sitting here 50 years later saying the same thing. So I don't understand what this block is and why there's this reluctance. Are people afraid of the truth? One might ask, you know, because it's I read this lovely article. I think it was, what's her name, Fanning? Q&A.
Fanning, the journalist.
Yes,
from
the journalist.
ABC. Yep.
She wrote this lovely story about her parents. They have a farm, and then she's got this really nice photo of these two Aboriginal women, a sort of matriarchal figure sitting in a chair with a dog beside her, and this younger woman throwing her head back, laughing. And she was intrigued, who are these women? And she sort of made it her journey to find out. And these women had been slaves, if you like, and been working with her family. And she actually tracked down the granddaughter of the smiling woman, young woman in the photograph. And there's this lovely photograph of her with that woman's family and what have you. So she's written this really nice story about the impact and, you know, that they actually were slaves to her family. But they were these sort of loving people, and it's a very, very nice story. And I read today too, just before I came, there's more and more people are doing this sort of like little family stories, and those sorts of stories, well, all stories are important in my view, but that just adds to this discussion about because the relationship, and no one writes about, there's a PhD out there for quite a few people to talk about the relationship between women, Aboriginal women, and non-Aboriginal women, because they were the only women there. You know, often it was just the station masters. Well, we're station people, by the way. So the station master's wife, she was there alone without her family, and that there was a camp of Aboriginal women. And a lot of them worked as slave. My mother was one, a slave. But I wonder what that interaction was. Mm. You hear and see snippets of it, sometimes in a story or maybe a movie. Some directors brave enough to talk about this relationship. And no one's ever written about this. And I think there's lots of interesting work that could be done here. And there was sexual exploitation of Aboriginal women. Lots of families around the country. I have an Italian grandmother. And, of course, she's not Italian. She's just, she's the station master's, probably their sister, you know, or their aunt. You still hear stories today. So, I mean, I think this is really, as a woman, I find this really interesting because they only had each other and they must have had relationships to sort of support each other. I know we looked after their children. My mother did that as well. We looked after their kids and they were lots of loving relationships as well because the mother was often too busy or lots of violence as well. So the kids would sometimes often go to the camp. So the Aboriginal woman would take them. And a little bit happened like that with my mother and those two. There's a lovely photo of her sitting on a chair and the two kids have got their arms on mum's shoulder. So those two children grew up and the daughter just disappeared because their mother was a bit of a tough taskmaster. But she got to know those children when they grew up because they left Darwin and went to live in Perth where they still are. So, you know, I reckon there's a whole world here that we haven't even peeped under. So anybody out there that wants to do something really interesting and relevant and useful and amazing, there's a few PhDs there.
That's the human relationship, isn't it? Sorry. It's the human it's the humanising of relationships, and so much of what's happened with our colonial experience has been dehumanising and trying to pretend the ingrained falsehood that there wasn't anyone here, and then failing to acknowledge even when it's obvious.
Yeah, I mean there were the massacres. I mean, that map that Lyndell Ryan is doing, and she's mapping all the massacres around the country. I think she's going up the East Coast, and it's just full of dots, and that's a really detailed work of scholarship, because she, the process that she uses, she hears a story someone tells her, then she checks it back. It's only when it's authenticated by some document or someone's written about it that it gets a dot on the map. So if she hears a story and she can't prop it up with some kind of evidence or in the library or letters in the family or whatever medium she uses, it doesn't make it a dot on the map.
Pat, there are so many issues here that I want to unpack a bit further and discuss a little more and then to start to look for some of the solutions as we move forward. But I think now might be a good time to take a break, and we will come back in just a moment to continue this conversation with Pat Anderson.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back. We are still here talking with Pat Anderson around a range of issues that we need to talk honestly about in Australia if we are to move forward and to think genuinely about healing and reconciliation and our identity as a nation. Pat, before the break, you were talking about the human relationships that were there if we look back in history, and particularly relationships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous women, between Indigenous women and children, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, and the fact that we've lost these human relationships somewhere in our history. We don't talk about them. And this seems to be a good place to kind of move forward and think about the Uluru Statement from the Heart. I mean, that's a remarkable document. It calls for a recognition of sovereignty. It calls for the establishment of a First Nations voice in the Constitution. But to me, it speaks so powerfully to the need to heal and for non-Indigenous people to take guidance from First Nations people about how we do that. Pat, can you just speak to the Uluru Statement from the Heart? You were deeply involved in that process, and share with us why it matters so much and what it offers us.
There was a whole process that led up to it. It was the work of the Referendum Council, which I co-chaired with Mark Liebler. It was a huge committee, 16 people. However, we went through a whole process talking to Aboriginal people across the country in groups of 100. The local people selected chose who would be at those meetings. We had a formula. We wanted 60% traditional custodians and owners, 20% of organisations, and another 20% of people that didn't fit those criteria but were important or influential in their communities. So that was a formula for every. And then that was, I went around, had 12 and an information day here in Canberra, and each of those meetings chose them to send people to the convention, which was held at the complex there at Yallara, but hosted by the community there at Mutijulu. And we had our opening ceremony and our closing one and a couple of functions as well out at Mutijulu. It's a small community, and there was, you know, there was 300 people, so it would be an imposition to try and house all those people at Mutijulu. So we went into the sort of main tourist complex there with everything that we needed, you know, lights, cameras, bloody sound equipment and air conditioning. Anyhow, that process came up with the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which is a profound document. So whatever happens, I think that is a real important, significant moment in the history that I've just spoken a little bit about, because it's much bigger than that, of course. The Uluru Statement, we decided that we would not present it to the Prime Minister, as has all the other bark petitions, that nothing ever happened except everybody, you know, having a sort of light bulb moment. Was a moment. So we decided that we would gift this to the Australian people as a gift of healing and even of love, friendship, goodwill. So we gave that, and it's still out there as a gift. It needs for Australians to pick it up, accept the gift, and do what's required. What's required is to convince the Prime Minister and his government that the country needs to go to referendum to enshrine a voice in the Constitution. What happened in all of the discussion, and it's been my experience as well, every organisation pretty much that we've set up, NAC, NAEC, you know, everything, by a quick signature on a piece of paper by the current minister has been dismissed, including ATSIC, which was huge, and all over the country, the government of the day, decided to, well, we're not going to do that anymore. So that's been where I and people of my gen, we've spent our life. So it was decided that through every meeting that we held, that we didn't want that to happen, and that we needed to take our rightful place, our political place that we occupy in the country, that we don't have one. We are absolutely completely powerless. We are at the whim and of every minister that's ever been, every prime minister, every town, you know, what happens is we have absolutely no power. So this isn't a grab for power. It's asking, it's explaining. Once again, we spend our lives explaining that we need to take our rightful place in our own country. That's why it's gifted, because it's the people, it's the voters who can change the Constitution, not the Prime Minister, not the government. However, they have to, of course, pass the legislation. So we Australians, all of those above 18, this is probably one of the most significant political things you're going to do in your life, is to change the Constitution. In fact, it's your turn. Every generation has had a run at it. We've been running at this since pretty much not long after the First Fleet came here. The gains and achievements that we've made have been totally through our own activism and supporters along the way. There is no doubt about that. And we're asking you again, as we did in 1967, we asked you for your help and you gave it to us. And we're 50 years later or whatever, we're asking you again. And it's your turn, it's your time. But it's only through our activism that we've achieved what we have and made the gains that we have. Nothing has been given. There's lots of, if you listen to the language, you'll find lots of passive verbs around us. Lost our language, like it was a used tissue. We dropped it and forgot about it. You know, we gave, you know, what, you know. So if you listen to some, you're like, you'll hear all these passive verbs. In fact, the language around us in itself, oh, there's some more for linguists to do some work on, just that language. And look, that's, so it's a gift to the nation. Now, if, and our knowledge, you would think, forget all your prejudices, you would think that any folk who've lived on a continent for 65,000 years plus might have something to say about the care for the country, the environment. We know lots about the caring for country. But it's as if even that really now more than ever, that essential important language, we have to be once again jumping at the skipping rope. Ask us. We know, you know. So it's painful, you know, that fires last year. It was so painful, you know. This need not have happened, really. This need not have happened. But you wouldn't listen to us. You wouldn't hear us. You give us polite space, but you don't, in fact, hear us. So the Uluru Statement is really, really important. It's a profound document. It will provide a narrative. The truth-telling and the agreement-making will... That in itself, I think, is dealing with the unfinished business. So the narrative for the country changes, and that we all Australians, whatever their background, will be part of this nation. At the moment, that's not happening. It hasn't in my, I'm hoping it happens in my lifetime, but, you know, there'll be people after me, that's for sure, because that's the only way we've made any achievements. And, you know, to sound, we ain't going anywhere. This is our place. And like it or lump it, we're here to stay. We've been here a really, really long time. So the statement is really important. We have to convince the Prime Minister, first off, that there is a groundswell of support for the Uluru Statement, not only this statement, but rather for the things that it says, voice to Parliament, so we can have our say directly up to Parliament itself. Accompanying that is the Makarrata Commission, which will oversee agreement making or treaties or however we decide to settle. And, of course, going close together is the truth telling, because that's essential. The sequence is really important, voice and then the other two to follow. The only constitutional change really is the voice, but because we need a vehicle, we need our own organisation, our own organisation, which not more than organisation, it's a voice, but it represents all the voices around the country, but which has cultural authority as well. So that's really important. All the other organisations we've had have been through an electoral process, and I think we have to find other ways that are purely Australian. And we've already talked about that. There'd be different language groups, however people organise themselves, not so much, you know, as you all probably know, the boundaries, you know, the state boundaries don't really apply to us. Our country straddles, in my case as well, straddles the Northern Territory and Queensland border. So those lines really don't mean too much to us. So the sorts of people who would make up the voice would be those people from all the different language groups. And there's we have to take into account the Stolen Generations people as well. So there is a whole other world way of deciding who the voice is, because its voice has to have, in my view, and the view of that whole process that led up to the Uluru Statement from the Heart, was that it would have cultural authority and people would speak for all of, you know, the smallest community, Kintore, Walgett, wherever. They would have somebody speaking for them sitting at the table here in Canberra, representing them and their voice and their different needs, because everyone has different needs. There's a huge diversity here. So we have the opportunity here to do something that's truly Australian. So that what we're asking in the Uluru Statement from the Heart, in my view, is profound on many. It doesn't matter which way you turn it. It has could have a profound impact on the country and the future of the country. What are our values? Who are we? What does it mean to be an Australian in the 21st, 22nd century? What are our values? What do we stand for? I don't think we know. We can fix this, but it's going to require a lot of fortitude and, dare I say it, a level of maturity and sophistication. But the task is ours. It's our turn. All of those above 18.
Pat, so. I think it's remarkable hearing you talk this way about the Uluru Statement. And it always seems to me that in the kind of public discussions around Australia's First Nations people, there's this sense of hand-wringing and what do we do? Oh, nothing works. What do we do?
Yeah, it's
here
too hard.
We have the answer. It's actually not too hard. It's a plan. Mm. It's a plan that can be enacted. Yeah. And so the way forward is actually crystal clear. You know, we follow these steps, but we need to listen.
It's a guide. It's telling the Australian public and our government, this is what we need to do and this is how you do it. It's not just an idea. It's a construct. It's a tangible. It's a guide with all the earmarks there on what one needs to do. We just have to work out the detail. You know, there's all this sort of lot of confusion around it. But some people say, oh, you know, the voice, you know, didn't tell us what the voice is going to look like. Well, you can't put all that in the constitution. The voice would be designed, and in legislation. And we don't want it locked into the constitution. We might want to change it, you know, because we haven't done this before. So of course, the design of the voice and what it would look like would be by after discussion would be in legislation. So we can change it and say, well, that didn't work. It was a good idea, but we need to change it. So of course, how can you write all of that into the? It just needs a couple of enabling sentences, really. Yeah. And then the rest is done in another process with us and the government of the day, and it'd be done by legislation. So it's really simple. I was saying too hard because anything to do with blackfellas, people say, oh, that's really hard, you know, and they don't all agree and they're always fighting and, you know, and they're this, they're too that or too something else, you know. You know, come on, get over it. That's not acceptable anymore. And I think, you know, we Australians can do better than that. We can do better than that, and now's the time to show who we truly are and where our heart is and to accept and be comfortable in this beautiful country of ours. We've got to look after it. Look, the Barrier Reef, you know, what's happened to that? And it's just, it's like hurts your soul to think about it. And watching, you know, the fires with all the animals and people and the insects and trees exploding, you think, oh, my God, Mother Nature, she is really pissed off, really pissed off. There is a relationship between all of these things, inanimate and the animate world are all connected. We are connected to the trees and the animals and everything that's on, you know, in our country. And it's a beautiful country. There's a reluctance even to admit that by some, you know. The deserts and everything, it's amazing. It's so dramatic. It's wonderful. But Australians seem to, I don't know, cringe at the thought of even talking about loving one's country. Come on. We have to do. I think we can, but we have to do a whole lot better. And there's some good things to do. Lots of really good work to do. You know, we have to really get involved in climate change because what did David Attenborough say? We do have time to fix the planet, but we should have started last Tuesday. That's really what he's saying. And we've got a lot of work to do in this country, you know, and we're sort of isolated, which might be good in the few years to come, but we got to fix country. We have to love it. We have to respect it. It's not to be raped and looted and dug up at every opportunity because there's something there that we desperately want. Thinking has to change. There has to be a much more closer relationship between us and the inanimate world in this country. And you have people who know about that because we've been here, as I said, a really, 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 really long time. There's no other country in the world that has access to the oldest surviving culture in the world. Is that not to celebrate?
Isn't that an extraordinary opportunity for Australia to embrace reconciliation, to engage in detailed truth-telling and to celebrate Indigenous vision for the future a recognition of the relationship with country, a recognition of First Nations knowledge frameworks. It's the most extraordinary framework. And I think in Australia we did begin to appreciate a little bit through the bushfire experience and the discussions that have come on through cultural burning. But as you've just shown so nicely and so well for us, that's the tip of the iceberg. How would you're calling, it's a call to arms, I think, for all Australians over 18.
Yeah. I mean, and we've done it before.
Yep.
I just remember the other day one of the most successful public campaigns was the, and you might remember too, to stop the Franklin Dam in Tasmania, and what people did at the, as well as, you know, everything else, all the actions that they took across the country. There was an election on, and what they got the Australian public to do was to vote, but right across their ballot paper, no dams. And there were so many of these ballot papers with no dams. The Australian Electoral Office, I think, made the decision themselves to count them, and they actually counted all of those votes so they could see how many Australians were against the Franklin Dam. So that's the kind of public campaign, and we can't do it. We don't have the numbers. We can't do it without you. It truly is a gift, but you have to pick the gift up. So far, we're getting a lot of support, I have to say, from all kinds of the corporate sector and others, individuals as well. But, you know, changing the constitution, as you'll know, it's really, really difficult in this country. So there's a lot of work that needs to be doing, and people can start. I mean, you know, write to your local member, ring him up, send him an email. It doesn't have to be, you know, War and Peace. It can just be a few lines. You know, tell the Prime Minister we support the Uluru Statement, and he needs to a voice enshrined in the Constitution, and we need to do it now. And we support it. You know, what, 3 sentences, 4 sentences, send him an email. Your local member, your federal member, even your local council, some of your larger organisations, like, you know, the Lions Club, and they, because they're really quite powerful, actually, you know, so they can lobby. We have lots of organisations as well, but we really need this to be a people's movement. And that's the only way that we are going to get real change in this country, because we can't just leave it to Parliament House. It's our house. The House of Representatives is the people's house. That's our house. Don't forget that. So we're responsible for what happens in this country by the people that we elect to go and speak for us. So if they're not doing what we want, we all know what to do next time. But this is something a little bit extra special. This is truly, I think, once in a lifetime. It's this generation's turn, and I think we're. There's more access to more information, but even just doing those simple things. So if they start getting flooded, they, the politicians of all persuasions and all levels, the levels of government, both local and federal, if they start getting flooded or people talking to them, you know, stopping them in the street, and when they do that sort of kissing baby sorts of things that they do, or kissing sheep or whatever they do as they go around, people can talk to them. Tell them I support this. So that's the only way that we can win this, is if the Australian people convince the Prime Minister that there is a groundswell of support. They aren't going to do it.
But we often talk in public policy theory and public policy analysis around policy windows, and when, you know, the politics and the public discourse and the evidence converge to open a policy window. And I think what you've described here is this remarkable opportunity where we don't have the political will, at least from government, but we do have that policy window ajar. Mm. And there is an opportunity to bring about change. And the way you've described this is the way in which all Australians can contribute to pushing that policy window open. Mm. And convincing policymakers, or convincing government in this case, that it is time for a change.
Yeah, it is. It's way past time. But I think, you know, there is a shift, but we need more than a shift. We actually need a whole movement. But, you know, we've done it before. We did it in 67 and helped us, you know, which and we have to do it again. You know, not only us at risk here, it's our continent. Mm. It's our land, our seas, our trees, our flora, our fauna, everything. I mean, we have no water in this country. So what's the government doing about water, for instance? I mean, if everything you touch needs some attention, needs doing, needs dealing with. And we're really smart, you know, Australians. Globally, we punch I hate using this expression, but we punch way above our weight. So we do have, and we're the leader in the science, medical technology. Look at the wonderful work we did here with COVID, you know, because we have this, it's got lots of holes in it, but we have a really, really good public health system. There is no doubt about that. But also the public is aware and knows a good public health system, and we follow the messages as Australians did because they trust that we have a really good system here, and we do, despite, you know, we always need sort of fixing and what have you. But watching that, how other countries reacted and how we did, I think, thank God we've got a public health system that works. And also, the government of the day and the ministers listened to the experts, and the experts were the public health physicians and all of the research and their networks as well. So that's what saved us. Lots of good things that we've done in the world. We've just got better things to do now. Well, more things to do, which are going to affect the emotional and social and well-being of the nation. And all of us who live on it, including the animals and the seas and everything in the sea.
Pat, I think we need to draw this conversation to a close, but there is so much more to talk about that we will invite you back so we can continue this conversation. I think so often, just speaking for myself, when we start to begin about how we engage in these conversations, how we engage in truth-telling, how we think about healing this nation in a way that is just to our First Nations people, it becomes really difficult and it becomes really painful. I'm coming away from this conversation with an incredible sense of optimism. You have just told us what we need to do. Mm. You have directed our policymakers and our political leaders to what action they need to take, and you have given us all, as Australians, the guidance of where we need to go now. So, listeners, it falls to us to act, and I hope that everyone that listens to this podcast can reflect on the pain that you talked about, Pat, and the need for us to tell truth about that pain, but also to take away the sense of optimism that I feel and the responsibility that we have to actually move forward. So, Pat Anderson, thank you so much. It has been an extraordinary privilege to talk to you.
Thank you, Sharon and Anna Greta. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Great to have you with us. Sharon, that was the most extraordinary conversation with Pat Anderson. I feel deeply privileged that she joined us today and share with us even a small amount of the knowledge that she's gained through her long career here in Australia. And I think it gives us a tremendous amount of insight into the need for truth-telling and reconciliation. And I was so deeply inspired by her last statements about a vision for Australia's future and how this process of a voice, the process of reconciliation, the process of truth-telling and celebration of our Indigenous heritage gives Australia the most extraordinary future. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, it was a remarkable conversation, wasn't it, Anna Greta? And there were so many points along the way where I would have liked to have 3 or 4 hours to just pick up on that one point and learn more from Pat's extraordinary knowledge. I guess as I said to her at the end, I come away from this with a sense of pain that I think is almost impossible not to have when, as a non-Indigenous Australian, we think genuinely about the history of this country over the last 200 and a little bit years. But I also have this sense of optimism that if we just listen and take our cues from people like Pat, and there are so many First Nations people like Pat that can share their knowledge and that want to share their knowledge, then I think we've got a pathway forward. And a couple of things that really struck me, when she described the Uluru Statement as a gift, What an amazing way of describing it. What an act of generosity. And what kind of soul do we have as a country if we refuse the gift?
A gift of healing and love was the words Absolutely. That she used. And it is, it's an extraordinary frame for us to look at that document. And the concept that we don't embrace that as a nation really needs to be deeply considered and discussed. I think her call to arms should be well heeded. I think we should all be engaging very much in this discussion.
I think too she talked, Anna Greta, about the values that underpin it. And they are values that we like to think are values of this country around fairness, around egalitarianism. I think we should think more about values of compassion and caring. But all of these things align, and her vision of a future for Australia that is extraordinary if we can respect the true history of this country. So, you know, we've got this pathway forward. We need to take it.
Absolutely. Now, I think for you and I, as we work our way through the Policy Forum Pod series this year, we will find ourselves regularly reflecting on the conversations we've had so far with our Indigenous friends and colleagues, and I'm sure there'll be many more of these conversations to come. I just want to take this chance to remind listeners to reach out to us. We're very interested to hear what you think of the discussions, and you can find us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum. And so we're quite active in the Twitter sphere in terms of new episodes that are coming out, both for Policy Forum Pod and for our sister podcasts of Democracy Sausage and the National Security Podcast. You can contact us directly at the podcast at policyforum.net. And we have an active Facebook group, which is a great space to engage in active discussion around what we've been talking about and to give us some suggestions on how we might do better. So if you go to Facebook and type in Policy Forum Pod, you'll find our group, and we'd be very, very keen to welcome you. Leave us a review. We'd like to hear what your thoughts are on our podcast, and we'd love to have as many subscribers as possible through. So do that through your favourite podcast platform, Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your particular podcasts from. Next week, we will be back again with another episode, and I'm very much hoping we can continue this conversation around Indigenous wellbeing for a little bit longer. And so I might leave us with that little tantalising bite. Sharon, have we got any more details on next week?
I think we will just leave people with the promise of another amazing conversation. And there is so much more to say about these issues. I think you're right, Anna Greta. We'll talk specifically about these issues over the next couple of weeks, but we'll be going back to these conversations that are grounded in Indigenous knowledge for the rest of the year, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. We're looking forward to it. I'll say goodbye for now, Sharon. See you next week.
And from me, Sharon Bessel, bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.